Before it's mechanized, before you have a power shuttle, you have to throw the shuttle across the loom, and it is very, very physical.
That was Simon Thurley on the strength that was needed by weavers before the process became mechanized.
By spinning the globe around a particular time, we've been interested to try and vary the sorts of things that we're looking at. You know, maybe war, maybe politics, maybe culture. But at the same time, if there is a theme that's come out, I guess it's the unexpected connection.
And that was Michael Scott discussing his new radio series, Spin the Globe. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find us in all good newsagents and on subscription. Visit historyextra.com/subscribe-today for subscription deals. And we have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. For details of these formats, head to historyextra.com/digital. In 1771, Richard Arkwright built the world's first successful water-powered cotton spinning mill at Cromford in Derbyshire. It was an event that's seen by many as the birth of the modern factory system. Our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, met Simon Thurley, the chief executive of English Heritage, at Cromford Mills, to find out how the site differed from the dark satanic mills of the later Industrial Revolution.
Right, so Simon, we're in Cromford Mills in Derbyshire. Mm. Tell us a little bit about this mill. Why is this one so special?
Well, first of all, it's the first, and that I think is pretty big accolade considering it's such a long time ago. I mean, this is built in the 1770s, and it's built at a time when the organisation of large numbers of workers in a single place and a substantial degree of mechanisation just didn't exist anywhere else. And one of the things I think, just sitting here in the sun, actually looking around at the mills around us, is it almost sort of seems like a prison on the inside. Not because it's grim, but because it's so enclosed. And the important point really was is that what Richard Arkwright was doing here was, of its time, totally cutting-edge technology. Mm. The way his spinning machines worked was something he didn't want other people to know about. He didn't want other people to copy. And so he didn't want people to get in. He didn't want industrial spies coming in to find out what's going on. And so although where we're sitting now, on the inside of the mill, there are quite big windows. And you needed big windows because you needed light to get into to the spinning machines. On the outside, it's incredibly severe because he didn't want people coming to peer in, nose in, and find out how he was doing it.
And it is sort of, like you say, walled in, isn't it, on all sides? So you'd have to have had a reason to be coming in here.
You would. And, of course, the very first mill, which is over there in the far back corner, was originally, it was just a single mill here. That one was built in 1771. He then added another one in 1776, 77, 1785. And eventually you get this little sort of
complex,
village.
Complex,
yes. Complex, I think, is a better word for these mills. But crucially, absolutely crucially, running through the middle is the water source.
Yes.
Because what we have to remember about Arkwright and the whole of this late 18th century phase, this is before the coming of the mineral economy.
Right.
This is entirely natural sources of power. His mills are powered by water. And the harnessing of these fast-flowing rivers in the Derwent Valley was the thing that made it all possible.
So where did this water come from? And this is obviously why he put his site here, because of that water source, I assume.
Yes, incredibly carefully chosen site. We're looking around us and you can see the land rising at the side. There are almost sort of cliff faces to our right there. The land rises up the other side very steeply. The water comes powering down this valley, powering down.
Yeah.
And it hits this huge water wheel, 23 feet in diameter, and hurtles it round. And you can still see in the side of the building the socket in which a socking great wheel, really huge mill wheel went in. And that was the thing that powered his spinning machines.
Yeah.
And of course, in these early mills, coal power and steam engines were sometimes used, but they were used for pumping the water back up the hill to put in a reservoir to get the water cascading it down again. And those early Newcomen type steam engines just were not good enough to power the machinery itself. They're good enough to pump a bit of water back, but they weren't. So this is entirely free from the steam engine.
And was there sort of evidence of other people doing this type of thing at the same time, or was Arkwright kind of ahead of everybody else in doing this?
Well, he built on the precedent of Thomas Lom, who had built a silk mill in Derby in 1721. But it wasn't the same thing.
No.
And very, very quickly, people started to copy the Arkwright-type mills. And in fact, you know, by 1797, there were 900 cotton mills in England, and about a third of those were, you know, essentially of the Arkwright type.
That's here. What, just over 25 years?
Yeah, so astonishing, it's not, astonishing.
From 1 to 900, it's...
And, of course, what you have to remember is the capacity that this put into the economy.
Yeah.
Because the thing that had been slowing down the whole of the weaving industry had been the ability to spin the thread, because at this point, the weaving still goes on in cottages. It was literally a cottage industry.
Yeah.
And Arkwright is building here on North Street, just round the corner. He's building a series of cottages with a loom loft at the top with big windows where the men are doing the weaving.
Right, okay.
Whilst in the mill here, the women and the children are doing the spinning.
Why was that? Why would the men have been better at doing the weaving? Why would they have done that type of work?
Well, of course, before it's mechanised and before you have a power shuttle, you have to throw the shuttle across the loom, and it is very, very physical, that sort of weaving. And, you know, the muscle in your right arm gets very, very big. And, and if you go to a hand-weaving factory today, you see these men, and they're very, very tough, and they hurtle these shuttles across.
You need some muscle.
You do.
I mean, just looking around us, it's a very pretty sight, and it's certainly, to me, not sort of reminiscent of the kind of the dark satanic mills that you associate with the Industrial Revolution. How does this mill compare to those later mills?
Well, you're quite right. This is very much the sort of green and pleasant land end of it.
Yeah.
And when a steam engine is invented by Boulton and Watt that is good enough, is powerful enough, is efficient enough to power the machinery rather than just pumping water, you get to a situation where you actually can use a steam engine for the rotary power that, you know, powers these mills. And what then happens is that the mills are freed from being by these water sources, and the mills need to get to places where they can be supplied by coal, which means they need to be on the canal network. And it's actually in Pennine, Manchester, in Pennine, Lancashire, in Manchester, particularly in Ancoats, where these big mills develop with huge chimneys, you know, big boilers burning huge amounts of coal brought in by barges into the centre of town. And the people who are working in those mills are living in housing built by speculators. They're not living in the beautifully made houses that you see here in Cromford. And you move from a situation where the model here was essentially the estate village. This is a rural agricultural model, to an entirely new way of organising and housing and accommodating labour, which is the urban way, which we then come to associate with the, as you say, the dark satanic mill side of things.
So Arkwright actually built a village for his workers. When was that built? Was that there from the start?
Yes, right from the start, because of course he wanted to produce the finished cloth, and therefore he needed places to put the looms, and the looms were put in the houses. So North Street is constructed with the loom lofts on the top. Yeah. And the great thing about North Street is a couple of the houses belong to the Landmark Trust, and you can actually go and stay in them.
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh,
which is really nice. So if you want to really experience this for yourself and feel what it must have been like, you can go and stay in one of these unique houses.
Oh, wonderful. And what sort of man was Arkwright, do you think? I mean, some people have sort of cast him as more of a shrewd businessman than a kind of genius inventor. Do you think that's fair? I mean, he sort of did use other people's technology, didn't he, to kind of get to where he was, to that position that he could open this sort of mill?
Yes, I think that throughout history you have people who are brilliant inventors, and if they don't have the business acumen, their inventions are either pinched by someone else or sink to the bottom and never heard of. So Arkwright has this remarkable blend of skills, if you like. He's incredibly entrepreneurial. He sees the possibilities of reorganising the manufacturing processes in such a way that they can all be controlled in one place. But for me, very interestingly, the models he looks to are traditional models, because they are the only models. There are no, you know, when you're he's inventing the factory. And as we look over there towards that building, to me, you're looking at something that looks more like a sort of Georgian street with these sash windows, you know, all piled up, but you could expect little doors. It could be a terrace. And the models that they had were very traditional models, and it was still very much a sort of domestic sized activity. This is emphasize again, it's only with the coming of the mineral economy that things broke out from the human scale. Everything here is of a human scale.
Yes, you get that feel definitely from being here. And what kind of reaction did he get to building this mill, and to kind of, you know, was he was taking people's work away from them, in a way, from people who've been doing that, you know, like cottage industry? How did people feel about that?
But I think to begin with, of course, the mills were only dealing with a very small amount of production. But by the end of the 18th century, they had certainly virtually wiped out any sort of cottage industry of people spinning.
Yes.
Because this was happening on such a big scale so fast. And the big feature really is the pace of innovation, the pace of inventions, and the rapid, and the water frame was it's a bit of machinery that he invents here that allows him to spin, but things like the flying shuttle and all sorts of other bits of kit that come thick and fast really propel this industry, the cotton industry, into an extraordinary position of world dominance, and literally world dominance. And yes, it not only wipes out any lot of domestic activity, I mean, it wipes out world activity.
Yes. And do you think people realise the impact that Arkwright's mill and his invention would have on England's industry?
Well, I remember first getting my very first computer, which is a thing called an Amstrad, and of course one had absolutely no idea I was sitting there writing my MA on an Amstrad what was about to happen to the world. One just didn't. This was intermediate technology then, and I don't think anybody could have predicted. And I particularly don't think anyone could have predicted the coming of the mineral economy.
No.
That was the thing that really changed everything.
Yeah. You mentioned a little bit how he built this village for his workers. What was his relationship with the workers like? Did he sort of looked after them by the sounds of things and made sure that they were...
Oh, it was pretty tough.
Oh, okay.
It was tough. I mean, you needed to... there's a bell out there on top of the...
Oh, right.
On top of there, and when the bell rang, you came here. If you didn't get in before the gate closed, work time, you were left outside, you didn't get paid for the day.
Okay.
I mean, it was pretty tough.
Yeah.
However, he did include latrines in his mill, and later, you know, things like, you know, ventilation and things were all concerns. So I don't think that you should start imagining the horror of ankoats in the
that's
century,
what I was wondering. Yeah. So the mills themselves today are sort of shells. There's no nothing in there at the moment, but you do get a sense of the immense space inside. What would they have been like to work in? What would it have looked like if you'd walked in? It would have been quite noisy, I assume.
It would have been noisy. It would have been, they'd have kept them as light as possible. I mean, you can see these are full of windows.
Yeah.
And of course, that was necessary because you were dealing with all these threads and everything. But the air was just full of dust.
Yeah.
And absolutely full of dust. It made them a tremendous fire risk.
Yeah.
And these mills, of course, were there was a substantial amount of timber in them, and the fires that happened in these mills were absolutely colossal.
I mean, there have been a few, haven't there, here?
Yes, huge. And there were a number of big technical challenges these mill owners needed to overcome, and the sort of holy grail was the fireproof mill.
Yes.
Because the dust was incredibly easily ignited, and you know, you suddenly light a candle, you find the whole mill blowing up.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a safe environment.
No.
I don't know what it was like to breathe the air, but it can't have been that great.
No.
And they worked very long hours. Mm. They worked very long hours, and it was life before protective state legislation, really. Yeah.
And you mentioned that children also worked yes. in these mills. What would their role have been?
Well, it's obviously quite skilled tending the machines, but there are all sorts of things that little nimble fingers
yeah.
and little...
So they were actually probably put to work.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm. Very much so.
And how, I mean, now, I mean, there was a huge seven-storey building here, which we only have the foundations for now. And the first mill that we've been talking about was an extra two floors, I
yes.
believe. How was it set up? So did you have the machinery at the very bottom, as you've got where the water wheel was? How was the where was all the technology, and where was all the work going on?
Well, the key thing is how you transmitted your power.
Mm.
Power transmission was at the heart of it, because you had this huge water wheel, and then you had to take from that wheel the rotational power and transfer it to the other floors.
Yeah.
And so you had systems of bands and drives, all of which were made of timber, taking the power up. And the dimensions of the buildings were very much determined by the sizes of the spinning machines themselves.
Yeah.
So they were ranged across the floors, and the power was taken up to them. So there was always going to be a limit on the size of the building.
Yeah.
And the principal limiting factor, at least initially,
yeah.
was, you know, at which point the drive of the power just sort of didn't become powerful enough to move your machines.
Yeah.
And eventually, they managed to translate the power from timber drives to metal drives, and at that point you could have the mega mills, you know,
yeah.
where you had the drives just going, you know, just huge length of the mill, and these huge metal machines. So the mills we're looking at today were very much limited by the ability to transmit the power.
Yeah, and it must be quite something to see.
Quite noisy too.
Yeah,
quite
yeah.
noisy.
So how what happened to Arkwright? So he after he'd opened these mills here, he went on to open others, did he?
Yes, absolutely. Several just around the corner, and these are quite modest architecturally. And
yeah.
he started to, you know, make them a little bit more interesting architecturally. And the one just up the road from here, Masson Mill, which he built in the 1780s, has sort of Venetian windows It becomes a little bit more pretentious, and by that stage he's becoming extremely rich.
Yeah.
And the mills are objects of prestige, and you know, they become tourist attractions.
Yeah.
You know, people come from far and wide to see this phenomenon.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a real phenomenon.
And what was the next step for industry?
Well, the next step was the coming of the mineral economy.
Yeah.
Was the invention of an effective steam engine.
Yeah.
One that could drive these things, and coupled with that metal power transmission.
Okay.
And what that allows is it to expand from the cottage industry that it literally is here to the absolutely vast industrial concern, and the later generation of mills that just dwarf what we see here.
Yes.
This seems quite big enough, especially in this rural valley.
Yes.
But
yeah.
when you get to the sort of next generation, if you go to the Ancoats mills, these are huge. And then you go on from there to the big mill towns like Saltaire. I mean, these are just colossal buildings.
Yeah. So do you think the Industrial Revolution could have sort of happened without Arkwright and his? Do you think it would have happened at that time that it did without him and his, you know, his innovations? What was anything else that was going on at the same time that
Oh, there were huge numbers of things going on at the same time. I think people enormously underestimate what was happening, particularly in the Navy, was very, very important. Britain was at war.
Yeah.
You know, this is in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, all this is happening, you've got to remember.
Yes, that's true,
this is absolutely colossal war. This is all-out war. It's a sort of war that the country had never experienced before. All previous wars had been wars about trade and had been fought between sort of oligarchies and countries trying to get trade. Yeah. This was an ideological war.
Mm-hmm.
And Britain was, it's back against the wall. It was like the First, Second World War. And the Navy and the Army were very rapidly industrialising themselves in a process, organising processes. I mean, the block mills in Portsmouth, where the Royal Navy was learning ways to manufacture hundreds of thousands of blocks for the pulleys and on the ships in the Royal Navy. And also very big buildings. The very large industrial buildings built by the Navy are extremely similar to this, built at exactly the same time.
Okay.
So there is a process that's going on there, and I think that Arkwright is part of a much wider a process of, for want of a better word, industrialisation.
That was Simon Thurley, Chief Executive of English Heritage, on location at Cromford Mills. Simon's latest book, The Building of England, is published now by HarperCollins. And Simon has written a feature on Cromford Mills in the December issue of BBC History magazine, which is out now. Also in this issue, you'll find articles on Alfred the Great, a talented Tudor matriarch, the Plantagenets, the Cold War, and JFK. Look out for our December issue in all good newsagents and digitally. And now we have a short advertisement break.
Art Under Attack, Histories of British Iconoclasm, is the first exhibition to explore the history of physical attacks on art in Britain from the 16th century to the present day. The exhibition examines the movements and causes which have led to assaults on art through objects, paintings, sculpture, and archival material. Highlights include Thomas Johnson's interior of Canterbury Cathedral, 1657, exhibited for the first time alongside stained glass, removed from the windows of the cathedral. Alan Jones's chair, 1969, is on display, as well as evidence of statues destroyed in Ireland during the 20th century. The show considers artists such as Gustav Metzger, Yoko Ono, and Jake and Dinos Chapman, who have used destruction as a creative force. Art Under Attack, Histories of British Iconoclasm, is open at the Tate Britain until January 5th, 2014. For more information, please visit www.tate.org.uk.
1066, 1605, 1914. Some dates become synonymous with particular world events in particular countries. But what was happening elsewhere in the world at the same time? That's the premise of historian and author Michael Scott's new Radio 4 series, Spin the Globe, which sets out to explore the less well-known circumstances and unexplored connections of four such milestones. Our books editor, Matt Elton, caught up with Michael to find out more about the series.
So what's the premise of your new series?
Well, the idea behind Spin the Globe is simply this. Everyone's got these key dates drummed into their heads, you know, from innumerable school history lessons and books they've read and commemorations, and that might be 1066, or it might be 1815 or 1914. And we know what's going on in one part of the world on those key dates. It's a particular event in a particular place that's made that date famous. But what I'm interested in is what else was going on around the world at that time? What happens if we spin the globe and take a look around the world? What kind of a sense of a connected global history can we get?
So how did the idea first come about? How did it first come to you?
To be frank, I was sitting watching the opening ceremony of the London Olympics. And as I was sitting there, I was thinking, one of the commentators was saying something along the lines of, you know, everyone will remember where they are on, you know, tonight as this key moment in British history. And I thought, yeah, you know, that's true. Everyone does have these moments in their lives where they just remember where they were and what they were doing. And the same goes for history. You know, the same goes for these key dates that I was talking about. And that got me thinking about, well, I wonder what else is going on around the world right now. You know, people who aren't watching the London ceremony, the opening of the Olympics. And that got me thinking then about what else was going on around the world in the past on these key dates as well. And as a result, Spin the Globe was born.
Fantastic. So which dates do you cover in the series?
Well, we're kicking off, because we're going out, the first episode's going out soon after Bonfire Night, we're going to kick off with 5th of November 1605 and the Gunpowder Plot. And then we're going to move on to 1066, probably one of the most iconic dates that's in everyone's heads. And then moving forward to 1914, because of the centenary of the outbreak of World War One coming up next year. And as we move towards Christmas, we're going to be finishing up with the birth and life of Jesus Christ.
Fantastic. So some fairly topical things in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we want to do. The extraordinary thing about this idea and this series is that there are any number of dates that we could hit upon and pick. You know, there are any number of famous dates that when we look back through the history books, we could pick on and then spin the globe around. And I think that's what makes it quite so exciting. But what we wanted to do for this first series is pick some dates, you know, like 1066, that are, you know, absolutely key dates in everyone's heads. You know, you can't say 1066 without thinking about 1066 and all that, and our very kind of way of doing history. And also dates which have particular relevance to the centenary is coming up and to the particular time of year.
Brilliant, thank you. And so the first programme is about 1605, as you say. What other countries and events do we visit in this instalment?
Well, we kick off in London, and the way we're doing each episode is to spend a moment talking with an expert as to, you know, why that particular event has made that date so famous, and to bring us up to speed on the latest developments, the latest insights, the latest thinking. So we start with the Gunpowder Plot, but then we quickly spin off and we're heading to Strasbourg, where the first printed newspaper came off the presses in 1605. And then we head a bit further abroad. We're off to Russia to look at the time of troubles surrounding the reign of Boris Godunov and the later sort of invasion of Poland and Lithuania and the kind of extraordinary difficulties that Russia faced at this time. And then we're off to Persia. We have a look at Shah Abbas I of Persia ruling at this time and his plans and his goals and his sort of tactics that he used to achieve those goals. And then we skip all the way around to the New World and we look at some of the very early expeditions going out in 1605 towards Maine and the characters involved in those.
And something that interests me as well is the way that these events sometimes kind of link into each other and affect each other. Do we get a sense of how the Gunpowder Plot affected these events elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's come out of this is fascinating. I'm not an expert in any of these periods, and so it's been as much a journey of discovery for me as it, I hope it will be for the listeners. And every time we spin the globe, everywhere we turn to an expert in that particular period and place to find out, you know, what are the key insights and ideas. And what has come out of doing that, and what I think our experts who have joined us have also found really interesting, is the way these connections come out of the earth when you spin the globe and you connect up history. And so one of the interesting ones in 1605 is that the expedition going out in 1605, headed by a chap called George Weymouth, that headed towards the coast of Maine and which was there as a trading expedition to begin with, was actually funded by the Duke of Norfolk, one of the foremost Catholic sort of figures in England at the time. Now, following, of course, the Gunpowder Plot, Catholics were not in particular favour. And as a result, the Duke of Norfolk was in no place to finance any future expeditions. But if history had been different, you know, if the Gunpowder Plot had not happened, then we may well have seen a Catholic sort of exodus from England towards these new foundations in the New World in several years earlier than we did actually eventually see proper colonial foundations being made in the New World.
And a later programme, as you say, explores 1914, which of course is going to be big news next year for the centenary of the First World War. But I mean, what else was happening while that was looming?
Next year's a very big year for the marking of the outbreak of war in 1914. And we start the programme in the Imperial War Museum, and we're talking with the curators and the experts. And of course, they're setting up a massive new exhibition to mark that moment and a complete redesign of their galleries. So we're there with them in situ in the middle of the construction site, looking at what they are choosing to focus on and how they think it's important to tell the story of 1914 at this important juncture. But then we spin off around the world and we're heading to, for example, to Venezuela. where Venezuela struck oil in 1914 and changed the future of their country forever. We also look at the story of Gandhi. Now, Gandhi had actually come from some very early successes in South Africa to London, where he was when war broke out in 1914. And he surprised the authorities by supporting the war effort in the best way that he could, setting up a particular ambulance corps. And that time of his in London was actually, talking with the experts, you know, quite fundamental to his later thinking. But we also then head off to German East Africa, where we look at the completion of an absolutely extraordinary railway that went all the way inland from Dar es Salaam. And we're also spinning the globe to New York, where despite the war clouds that were gathering in Europe, in the dance scene of New York in 1914, it was the foxtrot that was invented. And our expert here, well, we couldn't think of a better dancing expert than to turn to Len Goodman, the chairman of the judges of Strictly Come Dancing, and we caught up with him in his dressing room at Planet Strictly to talk about the foxtrot with him.
You touched there on all these events happening kind of in the lead up to the war. Do we get a sense of if people were aware that war was coming?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, obviously, certainly within Europe, very much so. And if you spin the globe out to somewhere like New York, I mean, obviously, our focus is much more of a cultural kind of hotspot. And there you get much less of a sense, particularly in 1914, that people's minds were focused on these things. Out in Venezuela, the situation in Venezuela with the discovery of the oil, as we were finding out, is such that, you know, people were struggling to come to terms with this, in many ways, invasion of their country, and also to deal with the way in which those oil revenues were then being parceled out in a pretty crooked manner, to be honest, as we discovered. So I think there the focus was very much on survival and the country's own interests as much as it was on the wider world.
Mm. You mentioned there as well that you visited the Imperial War Museum. What places did you visit and sources that you used were most useful or most surprising, I suppose?
Well, what we've tried to do, as I said, is every time we spin the globe and with each event that we start with, we've turned to the experts, and you know, they've been our guides to help us understand and unlock these different worlds that are all united by the time at which they happened. So, you know, in terms of sources, we're in the hands of our experts to sort of direct us to some of the most important readings and sources. And in some cases in the programs, we're bringing those readings to the audience as well. So we're reading excerpts from particular key texts, for example. And we've also been in the British Museum, where we've been looking at some beautiful images of Shah Abbas I of Persia, for instance, and working with the experts, thinking about what those images were supposed to say. And we've also been to the British Library. So there we were looking at some early versions of Sima Guang's comprehensive mirror to aid in government, I should say, is the English translation, which was his fantastic 8-volume history of Chinese history that was supposed to be a sort of tool to help those in government be better at governing.
And are there any themes that started to emerge as you put these programmes together?
Yes, I mean, I think in some ways, by spinning the globe around a particular time, we've been interested to try and vary the sorts of things that we're looking at. You know, maybe war, maybe politics, it may be culture. But at the same time, if there is a theme that's come out, I guess it's the unexpected connections. I think that would be the theme that's really struck me. I mean, one of the most surprising things that I've discovered in this journey is with the 1066 program. And there, of course, we know about William, Duke of Normandy, invading England in the Battle of Hastings. But it's also the case that the Normans had been very active down in southern Italy and Sicily fighting against the Byzantine Empire. And it just so happens that the King Harold of Norway, who actually also invaded England, and of course King Harold of England had to go and fight at Stamford Bridge just days before he then marched south to deal with William at Hastings, that King Harold of Norway had actually trained and learnt much of his skills in fighting by being a member of the Byzantine Empire's sort of special elite force, if you like, fighting against the Normans down in southern Italy and Sicily. So here you have an extraordinary piece of connected global network history that I think was really quite surprising to bring to the fore.
And if you had to stop the globe at a particular date or place that you've covered in the series, which would you choose? Would you be able to choose just one?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, I think each has their own merit and interest. And what's been quite interesting is what you can do with the dates that are closer to us in the calendar. Obviously, it's been easier. There's a lot more sources to be able to turn to. The last program we look at, thinking back to, you know, much more my period of the ancient world where I specialize in and the time of the birth of Jesus Christ. Here, it's a different kind of history we have to do because the sources talk to us in very different ways. And so it's been fascinating to look at some of the, for example, sort of bigger trends and shifts that are happening in civilizations, like with the Mayans and in Mesoamerica, but also in Korea. And at the same time, to look at some of the developing technologies around that time. So, for example, we look at the invention of glass blowing.
And in terms of the dates that you perhaps would have liked to cover, but you didn't have chance to in this series...
Oh, I think that's the joy of Spin the Globe. You know, there are so many dates that we could go to. And, you know, I'm very much hoping that the audience will enjoy this series and that Radio 4 will bring us back next year to do another. So, you know, let's hope that we can get lots more dates and spin the globe with them.
Fantastic. And finally, what message do you hope the listeners will take away from the series?
I think it's this. I, like many, you know, many people will have these strong and important historical dates carved into my mind, and they are strong and important dates. But I think the problem with them is that they give us something of a spotlit version of history. And what we're missing are the connections. And what I think Spin the Globe does very effectively and very interestingly is to help us all develop a better connected sense of global history. And I really hope that that's what the listeners feel that they come away with and they've gained from listening to Spin the Globe.
That was Michael Scott. Spin the Globe continues on Radio 4 on Tuesday the 19th of November. And you can listen to the first episode again online at the BBC iPlayer radio site. Well, that's almost all for this week. As always, do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we'll try and read out some of your messages in future episodes. One of our listeners who got in contact recently was Stephen Coulson from Newcastle upon Tyne. Stephen writes, "I've been listening to your History Extra podcasts for a few years now. They've been steadily improving in content and production values over time. Your podcast from the 31st of October, however, was exceptional. I thoroughly enjoyed both the topics covered, and I found the approach of visiting a historic attraction and investigating its history more engaging than the regular author interviews. The macabre slant on the Hungerford Castle segment, particularly in the crypt, was fascinating. Good job. Please keep up the good work. I'd love to hear more podcasts from other historical sites around the UK." Thanks for that, Stephen, and I do hope you've enjoyed today's trip to Cromford Mills. And if any of you would like to listen to the episode that Stephen was referring to, you can still find it on our website, historyextra.com/podcasts, as well as on iTunes and other podcast providers. And as well as email, you can keep in touch with us on social media. We're on Twitter @HistoryExtra. And of course, we're on Facebook too, facebook.com/historyextra. And don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you'll find lots of history news, blogs, features, image galleries, quizzes, and much, much more. Next time, we'll be joined by Alison Weir to talk about Elizabeth of York, while historian Mark White will be considering the presidency of JFK on the 50th anniversary of his assassination. Please do join us for that. The History Extra podcast was recorded in Bristol and on location in Derbyshire, and produced by Jack Fletcher.